welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Aaron Camel. I am an editor at large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor of Ad Fontes, and we need him now more than ever, Reese Laverty, the senior editor of the whole operation. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you.
Where would we be without you?
I don't know. We need.
I wasn't talking to you.
More than to me.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I was just waiting for whoever responded first. It's not you.
Just not talking about me.
It's the other guy.
Well, that's fine. Anyhow, this is the second episode that we're doing in our series on Oliver O'Donovan's Begotten or Made. And last time we just sort of like decided we were going to do work through it chapter by chapter, right? And so we started talking, and at the end of 55 minutes realized we'd made it five pages because this book is dense and wonderful. And so we're going to just kind of go at the pace that we think we're just going to go at the pace that feels right in the moment. We're just going to live in the moment, not in the past, and see kind of, you know, how everything hangs together. So we ended our
last conversation at the bottom of page five. I just listened to it this morning.
So we're going to the top of page six, right, for this one.
Yeah, but I think
if you're following along in the edition we printed at the Davenant Institute, which if you're not, you haven't got it, why not go to the show notes and buy it? But yeah, page five in our Davenant edition. I think we had ended basically on the huge moral question of whether new technologies create new ethical obligations if those technologies exist. In the overall theme that the book is addressing begins with the questions of IVF. I think we were talking about stuff like prenatal scans and prenatal care.
I just remember I made a reference to global hunger, and that was it. So
yeah, if you can feed everybody, should you feed everybody? Yeah.
And the bottom of page five talks about the doctor's obligation. The first obligation of the doctor is not to act. And when I read that and think about that as the ending point for our last conversation, the thing that comes into my mind is the loss in our culture of the Hippocratic Oath as a thing that we expect of doctors. So I'm wondering, like, one question that I have as I read this is, how relevant is this particular form of analysis? Does it rely and require a structure that's gone? So does it require us, if we want to sort of follow his argument, to obligate ourselves to trying to restore certain aspects of that previous structure? You know, should we try to use political means to reinstate the Hippocratic Oath? You know, those are questions that come up in my head. And then on a philosophical end, the concept that the doctor's first obligation is not to act requires, at a minimum, I think, philosophically, a conception of health as the good of the body towards which the doctor's art is aimed. And that just needs to be said. So he's relying on you having an understanding that the body has a natural end, which is its own health, its own ability to just continue sustaining and maintaining itself, and that the doctor is always trying to get you back to that state, as opposed to, you know, another conception of what could be going on with the medical art, which is to just ever advance the body to be in conformity with the will of the person who has the body, right? I just and if you go that route, I think we're definitely closer to that than we were when he was writing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he makes that explicit towards the end of the chapter, which I don't want to get too far ahead of us, but yeah, he makes, Colin, that very point explicit about nature, and so we'll kind of get there.
And that point of being subject to the will of someone is what he's set up in this distinction between that which is begotten and that which is made. That which is made, an object of artifice, is subject to the will of the person who made it, whereas that is not the case, sort of by necessity, with a person, a child who is begotten. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So medicine, then, we would say, is an art, and this always confuses my students. more like law, right? Medicine and law are both arts, and they're not sciences, properly speaking. Medicine is not an inquiry into the nature of reality. It's a practice that aims at an end. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so that being the reason we find that hard to get our heads around is that because we now have such a thing as medical science, which does actually create and do new things. Because especially sort of in the age of COVID, we have in our mind medical science is always kind of finding new stuff, doing new stuff, coming up with new things. Whereas sort of, I know, like the ancient inception of medicine, and although it's kind of researching and can find better ways of, say, treating illness, it's not kind of doing new stuff. I'm grasping at something here, but is this?
Yeah, you're right. So medical research, right? So there is a certain, is a wing of biology, we could say, which is like the study of the human body. And it's learning true knowledgeable things about humans and how they function. And we have bled or maybe, you know, perforated and ultimately lost the distinction between that medical research, right, as a scientific endeavor, which is a wing of biology, and the practice of medicine, right, which is being a doctor. And so the similar distinction would be, you can say there's some such a thing as a political scientist who's studying and looking for true knowledge about political things, and somebody who's a politician, who's a practitioner of politics. And that distinction, I think, is still pretty clear in most people's eyes, right? Nobody looks at a politician and says, that's just a science. That's a scientist doing science-y stuff. But we do sort of think of doctors that way. Because both of these things aim at an end, right? As an art, they're sort of taking knowledge and applying it to try to accomplish some end. And in the one case, it's the health of the body. And the other, it's the health of the body politic, right? And so both of these things relate to bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The social rather than the private body.
Your point about bodies, Colin, I think is helpful for moving us on to page 6. You know, I mean, we're moving rapidly here, so forgive me, guys.
Wind is whipping through my hands.
Whipping. But O'Donovan, you know, says at the top of page 6 that he's going to, you know, kind of sketch some general things that he thinks about medicine that he'll sort of sharpen up in future chapters. And then the next paragraph begins with this sentence. He says, "The relationship of human beings to their own bodies, we might say, is the last frontier of nature." And so he talks about the fact that the body is irreducibly given. This is his kind of, he says, we come into contact with the irreducible givenness of the body. And I think his point is to say that at least when he's writing, and I think still today, although less today, we have this kind of immediate relationship to our own bodies. And it's clear that our bodies we relate to them as sort of fixed realities with which we have to do. That they're sort of given to us, and we can't, you know, we can't. They're not sort of subject to our will immediately, in the way that other dimensions of nature might be subject to our will. Without that, and by immediately, I mean without the sort of mediation of technological devices of various sorts, right? So there's the kind of immediate relationship we have to our bodies. And O'Donovan sort of argues that this kind of immediacy is that which sort of makes the reality of nature, even for modern persons, inescapable, right? When we meet our own bodies, we meet something that's natural. It's just there. It's given. This is his argument.
You sit down in the bath, which, you know, we get in the shower, you undress to get into bed, and your body is there, whether you like it or not. Yeah.
Whether you like it or not. And your body, you probably don't like parts of it. I mean, I've like got all this tendonitis up and down my arm and leg right now, you know? It's like the body is given, and I don't like what it's, you know.
Nobody likes everything about their body, and you can try to work with your body, to amend and help your body function, but you can't change bodies. And I think you're right. This is why it's the last frontier of nature. We don't really think of our political or social body as natural the way Aristotle wants us to, right? And so this is part of my attraction to Aristotle. I think he's right about something that we're sort of missing nowadays.
Right.
You know, you
we think
can
of
change
political and social bodies as the realm of contracts, not the realm of sort of given realities. Yeah.
And you can change your social body, right? I could up stakes and move to Singapore and become a Singaporean.
You could move to Singapore. It's an open question whether you could become a Singaporean, actually. I mean, I think there's a lot of debate about that.
Pick another country where I could become naturalized, right? So a lot of people come to, you know, pick up stakes, move to America, become Americans, we would say.
Right.
So in that sense, it seems as if the social body is artificial. We've moved from thinking of it naturally to thinking of it as a constructed artificial thing. You know, no one, as Reese is pointing out, and as he says in the middle of that paragraph on page 6, when we take off our clothes to have a bath, we're confronted with something as natural and given and non-artificial as anything in the universe. There's something about my body that isn't like my body politic, where you can just kind of pick up a part from Mexico and plug it in, even though people are trying, you know, that we'll get there. It's like there are people, you know, I can't remember what's the name of that cultish community that moved out of China and into the United States because the Chinese government was harvesting their organs.
They do those shows. Yeah,
they're
like
in London all the
time. Shows
and
whatever.
I've just gone blank.
The Shenyan, and they run a Chinese language newspaper in the Bay Area here. But anyway, I mean, that would be the kind of analogous thing. And when we hear that, we're horrified. But when we hear about somebody picking up and moving to the United States or some other country, we think, hey, whatever, it's fine.
Good for you. Spread your
and it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think, Colin, to your point, he actually says that we relate to our bodies in the same way as we relate to the rest of the natural world. And so this is where I think O'Donovan, I think our reading of him so far, his technological critique in our contemporary context seems to cut against the left. And I think that's not
expand on that a little bit.
Well, which is to say that right now one of the issues that's sort of vexing the Western world is the relationship of what the proper relationship of the technological mentality to the body is, which, you know, how sort of under the control of the will should the body be? What sorts of alterations can we make to it so that it conforms to the will of the you know, embodied person? Those sorts of questions. And so O'Donovan, insofar as his critique of technological medicine, you know, it seems to have clear applications there. But I think he makes this point, which I think is well taken, which is to say that he says this. He says, before we can evoke and create new beings which conform to the laws we lay down for them by our making. So there, that goes back to the point we made in the first podcast, where O'Donovan says that if you make something, you become the law of its nature. So he says, before we can evoke and create new beings which conform to the laws we lay down for them by our making, we have to accept this being, which is to say our own being, according to its own laws, which we have not laid down. So the body, we have to accept it according to its own laws, which we have not laid down. If by refusing its laws and imposing our freedom wantonly upon it, we cause it to break down, our freedom breaks down with it. And then he says this is in fact the law of our relations with all nature, with the climate, with the soil, with the animal world. But in this particular case, it is forced upon our attention, one might think inescapably. Right. So what he's trying to say is that, you know, the kind of the risk that we run when we subject the body to our own laws, which is to say the law of our own wills, is that we forfeit our very capacities to act. And so this is actually a lot of debates in contemporary, like, you know, there's very fascinating, actually, a kind of a progressive feminist, I don't know if you have this in the Bay. Well, you probably had it a decade ago in the Bay, but in like the hip parts of Chicago and stuff, there's this like progressive feminist backlash against oral contraceptives really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And they're making these sorts of the feminists that I was reading in Chicago.
Yeah, we don't want our beef with antibiotics, you know, in it. Why would we want our bodies to be pumped full of these
right.
chemicals?
I mean, yeah. They're making these sorts, but the I think O'Donovan's argument that there's a kind of loss of potency, that actually certain dimensions of the way that our bodies can act are forfeited when we act upon them this way, and we actually lose freedom in that process, is an argument that I think is very striking. I'd be curious to get your guys' thoughts on it.
You are making me think, because when you said this, you said, how under our will should our application of technology be relative to our bodies? And, you know, again, the analogy between the body and the city is going to be ever present in my mind as somebody who teaches Plato a lot, but I think is applicable even here, right? So think about how different people in our own society would answer the question of how under the general will should our society's application of technique be on our own society or our social body? And you have the exact same sets of phenomena and questions are emerging, right?
Yep.
We have all these techniques of the manipulation of people's understandings of reality, right? So this is why everybody's talking about fake news or Russian disinformation and kind of the, like, who owns the social media platforms, you know, what is their interest in the social body? And that it applies there. It also applies in COVID and vaccine mandates and, you know, these other aspects of, you know, it's my private body is not really quite as private as I think it is. I mean, it is ultimately private in a certain sense. When I die, it's me, not you, right? But it's also public in the sense that, you know, when I take off my clothes to get in the bath, it matters if I do that in my own bathroom with the door locked or if I do it, you know, at the fountain in the middle of campus, you know, because there's a certain social aspect to being seen, to being visible. So all this to say, I think one thing readers just if I had to like summarize this, because we're dealing with some kind of weird. We're getting a little out there, and I think that's good, right? I think it's fun. And hopefully people can track with us. If you're having a hard time and all that seemed a little crazy, just remember this. When you're reading O'Donovan, and he's making these arguments about the body and technique and individual freedom, he is not, I think, very, very... I think we could say this with confidence. He is not just talking about that. He's also aware that all of these things can be applied to the city... Or to politics, however you wanted to frame that, you know, when you talk about the techniques ability to manipulate the human body, you're also always talking about the human ability by technique to manipulate the social body.
I think that's right. And you just have to sort of assume that that's floating in the background precisely because he's already invoked Elul. For Elul, that's like central.
Yeah. So a technological society from Elul is not just one where there is technology, but where you look at everything with a technological solution. You know, you have a technological hammer, so everything looks like a nail, which I think is what Onsi was kind of getting at when he was speaking about this. Speaks both to left and right today in 2023. At the top, page 7, you know, this is the law of our relations with all nature, with the climate, the soil, the animal world. You know, most of us are gonna, and he addresses later on in the book transgenderism, or what he was then calling transsexualism, O'Donovan, and we're kind of probably got that in our ears. And on the left, the question is, are the left applying this technique to the body to too great an extent, which is a live issue in many ways. Today in the UK, the UK Parliament in Westminster announced it's going to block Scotland's attempts to reform its Gender Recognition Act to allow children under the age of 18 to apply for a gender recognition certificate, because it's something, in theory, is a healthcare matter devolved to Scotland, but the UK government is stepping in and saying, actually, no, this is an equalities thing and that isn't devolved, etc. So, you know, a live issue, Scotland being a very left-leaning country. But on the right, like O'Donovan touches on, nature, soil, animal world, etc., we will say generally the caricature is that it's the right who will apply technique too much to the created world and will be blind to climate change and environmental degradation and whatsoever. But then again, the solutions that then perhaps more green left-wing people will point to are always technocratic. It's all
they want to technically manipulate
carbon capture and, like, you know, carbon credits and, you know,
the solution is always, we don't basically need to change our behavior. We just need to come up with the technological solutions, which is Paul Kingsnorth, if people are familiar with him, his kind of overall critique and why he was sort of dropped out of the green movement in many ways, was a loss of the kind of wonder at nature and a failure to acknowledge that there is a spiritual malaise here, which we cannot solve just by increasing technocratic solutions. A thing that's gone viral-ish among kind of right-leaning folk this week is it's a debate at the Oxford Union on the motion, "This House believes woke culture has gone too far." And the guy kind of speaking for the motion is he sounds English sounding, but he's sort of Russian extraction. And he sort of tried to speak to the reasonable woke people. And his point at the end is like, complaining and throwing soup on paintings is not going to save the climate. What we need to do is invest all of our energy in, you know, carbon capture, et cetera, all this kind of stuff. And all the conservatives are like, yeah, yeah, great, stick it to the woke guys. Blah, 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 blah. But it's just another technocratic solution. It doesn't get at the technological malaise, the need to grasp and submit everything to our technological solutions that kind of caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
So just to try to hear a couple of our thoughts, in, you know, answering to similar questions, we heard Anzi try to kind of paraphrase something that O'Donovan's getting to at the top of page 7. I would love to hear Reese. You know, I'm going to read a quote and I want you to try helping me get my head around it. So this is right after he quotes from Paul in Ephesians saying, "No man hates his own flesh, says St. Paul, but nourishes it and cherishes it." And then he says, "To hate one's flesh is the limit of self-contradiction to which our freedom tends." So what does that mean, his own phrase there? And he's relating it both to St. Paul and then to the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And I'm, you know, again, this is like one of those weird places where he's taking the Christian scriptural tradition or the creedal tradition and then applying it to this contemporary problem and helping us to use it to think through something. So, yeah, how is what Paul's talking about a limit of self-contradiction to which our freedom tends?
Yeah, well, to wind back slightly, something that leapt to mind earlier, when O'Donovan says on the previous page about the body being nature's final frontier, I don't know about you guys, but that phrase, of course, made me think of Star Trek. And you thought of Aristotle. I thought of Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry. But, you know, the read on Star Trek and space in general is that, you know, we discovered the New World, and so Westerners went over there, and we had the frontier, da, 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 and we pushed the frontier back, and oh, now everyone lives all over America. Okay, let's go to space instead. And we're still exploring space whenever, but the kind of space race sort of dwindled, and Elon Musk is doing his bit to kind of try and revive that, whatever. But it's almost too big space for it to kind of retain our attention as a frontier. But we kind of feel like we've conquered that frontier. And so if you have a kind of deep commitment to just freedom as a kind of bare principle with no deeper definition really of what freedom is, then you're always going to be pushing against whatever the next frontier is. And if you've conquered land and sea, if you've conquered space, eventually you're going to look around and you're going to look at your own body as this stubborn, seemingly immovable object in nature. But hey, the New World once seemed untraversable. The Cape of Good Hope once seemed untraversible, but then, you know, Francis Drake circumnavigated the globe, and space once seemed introvertible, but then we had one small step for man and a giant leap for mankind. And so if your value is just freedom unrestrained, or freedom, as O'Donovan will go on to define that, freedom from suffering, and that's your only definition of freedom, and you feel like your body is causing you some suffering, in whatever reason, then your freedom will tend towards self-contradiction and self-destruction, because you want to contradict yourself. But actually, it's not long before you, when contradicting your body, will just end up destroying your body. That's kind of where
it doesn't start off that way, right? It, like in the mind of the person who ends up in that space, right? I think you can begin the process. At least something that's very common in the Bay Area right now is biohacking. I don't know if you're familiar with this term.
Yeah.
You know, people gathering all this data on their own body, their sleep patterns, their chemical levels in their blood of various things, and their heart rhythms, and just everything. And then using that and subjecting it to kind of thinking about what ideal health patterns are like. And then they do different things. Like, if I do this many push-ups rather than that many, does it create the kind of maximized outcome according to the data? And so you can begin with biohacking, from the goal of trying to maximize your potential. But eventually, is O'Donovan saying eventually you're going to hit a limit to what your potential is going to be? Is he just kind of committed to death as a result of the fall? Or is he saying that there's something intrinsic to that way of thinking about the body, which will result in the sort of demise of the body? Because eventually, let's say I manage to crack the code, I get in there and I manipulate my DNA so that I can have 8 arms and, you know, I'm super buff and, like, you know, I do everything that I want with my body and my body becomes exactly what I want it to be. If that happens, then I'm no longer a human. I'm no longer me.
I don't think he's making a claim about how this, I don't think the contradiction is something that happens concretely in the world. I think the contradiction is at the level of understanding our actions. So if you read, so in here, so I think what he's trying
so
to say
is, so it's a limit in an epistemic sense.
The activity is incoherent is I think what he's saying. Yeah. So he says, he starts this way. He says, to hate one's own flesh is the limit of self-contradiction to which our freedom tends. It is the point at which our assertion of ourselves against nature becomes an attack upon ourselves. So nature there is our own flesh, I think. So when he says to hate one's own flesh is the limit of self-contradiction to which our freedom tends, it is the point at which our assertion of ourselves against nature becomes an attack upon ourselves. He's saying that when I hate myself and wish to master myself, in order to master myself, I have to operate upon myself. And so my desire to overcome nature becomes a desire to overcome me. I think that's what he's saying. And so,
okay, but that does apply, I think, right? To my situation of the biohacking individual who kind of takes it to the...
No, it does. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't think O'Donovan is saying that there's some sort of, if I do this enough, then we'll get to the contradiction. I think he's saying the contradiction is in the activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be the case that ultimately, and I think he thinks this, he says this elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm not free if I'm thinking of my body as the thing that has to be manipulated in order to accomplish my end.
I think that's part of it. And the other part of it is that my desire to liberate myself, which is out of some sort of misbegotten self-love, terminates in the hatred of myself, the desire to overcome myself. And so you have
emphasized some of the words in the sentence you read slightly differently. It's the point at which our assertion of ourselves against nature becomes an attack upon ourselves, like
right.
To assert yourself against yourself.
Right.
And I think, I think after that, he's then trying to square the kind of basic first fact of a syllogism that Paul says, no man ever hated his own flesh. Like, that doesn't happen. But right. Why do we see people seemingly hating their own flesh as they apply medical technique to themselves? How do you kind of keep the sort of, you know, like I said, philosophical syllogistic truth of Paul's assertion when you do actually seem to see people like hating their flesh and hating themselves? It's because that self-hatred is a kind of self-assertion. They think it's a form of, it's a very warped form of self-love, which is actually a form of self-hatred.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's a claim that, it leaves me with like, so what do you do with the biohacking thing? Because, you know, clearly there's like some good insights and people develop better habits as a result of this in many cases. But it seems as if he's saying, once you go down this path to decide that your body is just the clay that your will is using to mold yourself into reality, it seems like he's committed to saying you have already decided that you either hate your body or that you've sacrificed your freedom.
There are different kinds of biohacking, right? There are different degrees. Some of them are probably relevantly similar to just the exercising, right? It's like, oh, I've got this body and it's good for me to take care of it. And so I should try to like do right by myself, sort of a thing. And I think other forms of biohacking are far more insidious. And so, but I think what O'Donovan is concerned with is the overcoming of the body. And I think here he's probably not thinking about contemporary. I mean, he does, as Reese says, he talks about what he calls transsexualism, but I think probably here he has in mind second wave feminism, right? Where this sort of, not exclusively, but in part, but I think in the radical second wave feminists, who are always fascinating and worth reading, I think, there's a kind of honesty about the desire to overcome the body, right? That the sort of the female body is actually this obstacle that needs to be overcome so that equality between men and women can be achieved, right? And so I think that's the sort of mindset that he's talking about, not the kind of, you know, Silicon Valley, you get into these weird like optimization, like if I fast for like 23 and a half hours.
Yeah, those
then
are definitely
that'll,
the people I hang out with.
Right. I know. But my point is, like,
they sound
I don't think that's what he's like.
Fun.
He's not talking about like self-optimization. I think there's probably something disordered with that as well. But I don't think that's what he's sort of like.
Well, he's okay. On his way there, obviously, like, to keep the immediate context in view, is IVF. So it's interesting to consider how he would view IVF, which doesn't, in many ways, is a kind of a quite an uninvasive process compared to, say, the transgenderism stuff that you know, we, I think, more immediately think of when we're reading this in 2023. But he's kind of even talking about IVF as a relatively unintrusive, though it is intrusive and inappropriate in many ways, if you want to go back to the last episode we did on this, kind of technology, to even view that as an assault on the self, when IVF doesn't involve you, like, hacking yourself and like putting in new tubes and whatever, you know. Not then anyway. Connor,
I think I've resolved it internally. I actually think he's not, you're right, directly addressing it here, Anzi, but I'm sort of, I've got his argument in my head as I'm sort of thinking through conversations I've had. And I do think he's saying, if we connect this back to this concept of the body as a thing that has health, right, that health is the end of it. Mm-hmm. If you see the end of the body as maximization of the body, you have sacrificed the body. Because the end of the body is health. And so you, just by misunderstanding it, you are going through a process that is going to destroy it. And I actually think that the Christian tradition would say it's perfectly acceptable to destroy your body. You know, martyrdom, to sacrifice your life in order to defend your country, your family. There's all kinds of reasons why you might sacrifice the body. So the body is not the highest end by any means. But
well, you can allow the body to be destroyed.
Yeah, you don't destroy it yourself.
Yeah,
unless
that's
you're
right.
Like, I don't know, I'm going to hit detonate to kill all the Nazis in here, and that means I'm going to die too, you know?
Yeah. But the maximization, to think of the body, or I'm thinking, so I'm thinking those are the extreme cases, let's take a less extreme case. I think it's fine to sort of push your body in ways that are going to ultimately be not ideal for the body in order to accomplish some other good goal, right? So like glory in a sporting event that you're, you know,
committed
to for your
town.
This
is Paul. Physical training has some value.
Yeah. But if you think that the point of the body is the maximization of the body, I do think you logically end up where he's saying that you're going to have to end up, because you sacrifice the health of the body for the maximization of the body as body, which ultimately is going to make no sense.
If you think that the maximization of the body is the end of the body, you'll wind up actually subverting the body to maximize the body, right? Which is why biohacking doesn't end with the number of push-ups that you do. It ends with like implanting chips in yourself so that you can like, you know, do various other, or getting like barcodes tattooed. And, you know, I mean, like stuff like that where it's like it actually starts.
Or finding out that like if my spleen was half as big as it actually is, I would live longer as long as I ate only wheatgrass, you know, and then people do these weird, completely random surgeries on themselves that are not necessary, and then they go wrong and they die.
right. So okay, so that's the self-contradiction. So we've unpacked.
Sorry for the sorry
to all our wheatgrass eating listeners.
For all of our half-spleened listeners,
anyone who's
like
insecure about the size
Colin's
of their spleen
sensitivity.
To be fair, that was a thing. Yeah, it's an insult in Shakespeare. Oh, he's full of spleen.
Yeah, if he had half the spleen, you know, Shakespeare wouldn't have insulted him.
Yeah. So that's what the contradiction is. And then after addressing what he thinks this contradiction is, O'Donovan asks, what is it that draws us to this self-contradiction?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's halfway down page 7.
And this is where he starts talking about freedom. So he says, what is it that draws us to the self-contradiction? And then the next paragraph, he talks about freedom, liberalism, the liberal revolution, and just starts like throwing terms out that he doesn't define until much later. So let's like start trying to unpack, you know, some of this stuff. So what is it that makes us, out of our desire to assert ourselves, makes us actually hate ourselves? What is it that draws us to that self-contradiction?
So my first scribbled sin. There you go.
Thank you for that, Colin. That was very helpful.
Go home, kids. Go home. Take your coloring sheet out of Sunday school when your parents ask what you learned today.
Make sure to show your parents what Colin taught you. You know,
it's true.
It's true, but that's we can't waffle on a podcast for 50 minutes, here. Colin. If that's all we say, this isn't a catechism. No.
You don't have to say deep things. You just have to say them at great length, Colin. That's, that's the key. We need the content.
Like I normally do.
That's right. We need the content.
Sorry, Reese.
So back to where does this this tendency to self-destruction come from? My scribble in the margin here is just chicken and egg, ? So if I quote from the middle of that second paragraph on page 7, technology derives its social significance from the fact that by it, man has discovered new freedoms from necessity. The technological transformation of the modern age has gone hand in hand with the social and political quest of Western man to free himself from the necessities imposed upon him by religion, society, and nature. Without this social quest, the development of technology would have been unthinkable. Without technology, the liberal society as we know it would be unworkable. So the question that comes out for me there is, does the advent of these new technologies, which allow us to, you know, overcome certain barriers, does that kind of beget in us this drive towards self-contradiction? Or is there already a pre-existing drive towards self-contradiction, which leads to these technologies being created? Or is it just not as simple as that?
I mean, he leads this paragraph. So this is the bottom of page 7, the paragraph that we're talking about. He actually leads it by asking what is it draws us to self-contradiction. And I think he is trying to finger the liberal revolution. And so there's two terms there that he's using simultaneously, liberal and revolution. So I think that he does not think that technology comes first. I think he thinks a particular answer to the eternal social questions of human existence comes first, and modernity involves
as a historical and not logically first, like historically first.
Yes, historically first. Right. Historically, there's a transition that happens in the modern era, and people are going to argue why this happens, and we probably would have to go to a different O'Donovan book to answer it. Where the answer to questions about the relationship of social hierarchies, I think, you know, are these good? Should they be here? Should we have monarchy? Should we have democracy? How do we structure our economic relations with one another? And I think I would be fine just saying, let's just talk about the French Revolution, that, the French Revolution is a radical upending of the social relations of the various peoples of France. And then it spreads out from there to the rest of Europe. And that's the first place where we really see it in action, the liberal revolution.
But I think, Colin, to your point, the connection between, so he talks about the connection between liberalism and technology. I think he wants to say that these are all sort of at the root, a desire for freedom from various kinds of necessity. So, I mean, I'm just thinking now about debates that you and I have had about Descartes, right? Because one of the reasons you so dislike Descartes is because you see in Descartes, and you see this in Bacon, and you see, you know, in some of these other novatores, you see this,
the point of human knowing is the medical technology that it could give us.
But you see this idea prior to the advent of technology that can realize this idea. You see this idea that we can free ourselves from suffering by means of scientific and technical advancement. And so that idea precedes the development of the technologies that now make that idea so plausible to us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. And so this idea gives us the French Revolution is what I was trying to say. It's not that it comes from the French Revolution, but that
Yeah.
That and you know, the kinds of people who hold to this idea would look at the French Revolution and say, why didn't that work? They would say, well, we haven't quite got the technology yet, but that doesn't mean it's not worth giving another try.
And doesn't even, isn't there a point in Aristotle talking about slavery, Colin, where he basically says, if we had a machine that could do all the things that slaves do, I think life would be very different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Slaves being, you know, for Aristotle, let's say, a grim necessity.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. You wouldn't need slaves if we could build machines to do all the stuff. And there was a great book that I'm not going to be able to remember the name of it, came out a couple of years ago, which goes through and looks at the sort of philosophical that, you know, all these things that we now think of as robots and artificial intelligence and whatnot, you know, people were thinking about this stuff thousands of years ago in the ancient philosophical tradition, but it was just thought puzzles at that point. It was like, what if this statue could come to life and like right. answer mm-hmm. our questions for us and talk to us? Like, we wouldn't need friends. Like, you know, well, there you go. That's a chatbot. That's ChatGPT, right? And you've got all these people sitting there asking it questions and sort of tickling themselves with the answers that they get.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So the liberal revolution, yeah. I think, comes first, and it's a set of philosophers who change, and this is as you're alluding to, so we'll just go to Descartes, right? So I'll give you my version of Descartes. Obviously, Anzi is going to disagree with this, and it's a highly contested position, but you know, you do see in Descartes, there's a point where he says, you know, you might ask me, why should you use my method? And he says, and well, if you use my method, we will have great advances in medical technology and be able to live a lot longer. Mm-hmm. And so right there, what's the point of the human intellect? You know, one reading is to say that in modernity, the point of the human intellect is not the contemplation of God. It's not the eternal quest for wisdom, which is sort of ever elusive, but always enjoyable to hunt, you know, like that might be a way of sort of talking about the Platonic tradition. No. The point of the human intellect is at its highest point to alleviate suffering, to make our lives better, to free us from the constraints that reality only seemingly imposes on us as limits. And so there's a presumption that all these things are not real limits and that we could actually sort of resolve, you know, we could resolve all of the problems of human existence if we just thought it through clearly enough. And that's the liberal revolution, I think, that he's referring to. And right. it then has political consequences. It has technological consequences, but it's a philosophical position before it's any of those other things.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. As you said, I disagree with the Descartes stuff, but I think as a description of that sort of general movement, I think that's absolutely right. So then he starts talking about this in relationship to medical technique. This is at the top of page 8. So he talks about the liberal revolution in the abstract. You know, it's the desire to be free from suffering, various kinds of suffering, political suffering, social suffering, physical suffering. And then he sort of homes in on physical suffering and starts talking about medical technique. And so he says, that just to kind of set the topic, he says, medical technique too has been shaped and developed with the intention of fulfilling aspirations for freedom. Freedom in this case from the necessities imposed upon us by our bodily nature. So that's kind of his opening salvo when it comes to medical technique.
And this obviously is going to come into tension, and he does, as he does in the next sentence, because that sounds great, right? That we're going to have freedom from certain aspects of our bodily nature, right? You were talking about your tendonitis or whatever, and somebody else has got carpal tunnels, and, you know, I've got a bad back, and everybody's got their problems. It'd be great if we could be free of these problems. I have a very good friend who's in a writer's group that I'm in, who's a little older. He, you know, he's done all kinds of great and interesting writing and editing in his career. He's in his 60s, just got his knee replaced. And when he biked to the writer's group where he normally sort of shows up and hobbles with a cane. And he says, let me tell you, as soon as they say you can get your knee replaced, get it replaced. It's just like, please, <fuck." laughs> you know? And so, you know, that's the attraction. Now the problem right. is there are certain necessities of health, which we might not like or enjoy. And pregnancy is the one that he points to, right? Anyone who's right. known someone who's been pregnant, as I think we've all known people that are pregnant, even though none of us have been pregnant with anything more than a philosophical insight. you know, pregnancy
or a pause. But I've never been pregnant with a pause.
Anyway, pregnancy involves a certain amount of suffering. Pregnancy is not always fun. And so there's certain aspects of my bodily existence, because my private body is related to the public social body. My body is going to have to suffer a certain amount in that set of relations. And, you know, should we be freeing people from that? And if so, there's always a loser. So the person who gains also inflicts that gain as a loss on someone else. And so I'll give you, he gives you pregnancy. I'm going to give you another example. And then if somebody else wants to jump in, that's fine. But the other example that pops into my mind is incels. And so you've got incels, right? You got like more men who
involuntary celibates is the,
involuntarily
that's like
celibate.
Internet speak for people who are celibate and wish mostly, they were not.
Mostly guys who can't find girlfriends or nobody wants to sort of be their girlfriend or wife or something. So they're involuntarily celibate. And, you know, do they, if you want them to achieve the dreams of the liberal revolution and get what they want, and they do, and actually they talk about this online, like universal basic girlfriend is sort of one of the jokes that they make. You know, should that's their gain, right? Their freedom from their involuntary celibacy is inflicted as a loss. We presume, because these girls don't want to date these guys, on the girl who would be forced to date them if we found the social technology to provide the universal basic girlfriend, you know, to these young men. And so, again, that's just to say what he's talking about, I think, opens up a whole sphere of problems that you can see where this freedom might be great when it's applied to certain categories of things. And yet, when you apply it to other categories, there is a 1 to -1 correlation between someone's gain, you know, me not having to suffer from the pregnancy that I have, is someone else's loss, the death of the child that I abort.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an interesting, so help me out here, guys. So the next sentence after that first sentence that was illustrated really well by Colin, he says this, but not until recently has society ventured to think that medical technique ought to be used to overcome not only the necessities of disease, but also necessities of health. As a sort of factual claim, that seems to me obviously false. And he says that this bears witness to the Christian influence on medical practice. But like, if you look, I mean, go to the Protestant social teaching book, you know, our chapter, Stephen Wedgeworth's chapter on the Christian history of discussion about abortion. I mean, Christian theologians have always condemned abortion. They've always condemned contraception until you know, the 20th century. But I mean, presumably they feel the need to condemn these things because people are doing them, right? And I mean, so, which is to say that people have actually been engaging with medicine this way for very, very long time, both in Christian and in non-Christian societies, right? I mean, contraceptives are very common in the ancient pre-Christian world. Abortion, infanticide, very common. So I wasn't quite sure like why he made this claim or even what hangs on it. And so I was hoping that maybe you guys could kind of help me make sense of the, I mean, it seems to me that like actually people have always related to their bodies this way. And it's actually very difficult not to relate to your body this way. So, and by this way, I mean, you know, relate to your body wanting to overcome not only the necessities of disease, but the necessities of health.
I mean, I have a response, but if Reese wants to jump in, I'll give you the...
No, I'm mulling.
All right. So I think what you're missing here, Anzi, if I'm trying to defend the text, right, it would be to say the distinction he's making is not that no one has ever attempted to overcome the problem of pregnancy before. I think what he's saying is that for the first time, at least in, you know, the history of Christian civilization, society is venturing to think of medical technique this way.
And that it ought to be used to overcome those things.
Yep, as opposed to individuals thinking. And so the distinction, if you want to sort of make another example, obviously people have thought up the idea that if I murder the guy who's getting in my way, I can get what I want. but never until more recently did you have societies sit down and say, well, if we just murder all the people getting in our way, we'll just, you know, we'll be able to get what we want. And that's fine. And that applies both to Marxist and fascist regimes that we've seen really go whole hog on that. Whereas I just don't think you saw that happening on a mass social scale. And people will say, like, well, what about this? You know, the Crusades, this, that. It's like, no. These are categorically different levels of inflicting of death, right? There's a way in which sort of fighting combatants, you know, on a field of battle is just radically distinct from rounding people up and getting rid of them.
So on, to go back to Auntie's examples of abortion and contraception, then, yes, these things have been around since the ancient world, but the taboo around them, well, there was taboo around them. And even though you may have known that, oh, it's very widespread, you know, a society in which things are still kind of formally illegal or socially frowned upon, and yet those things still happen, is very different from a society in which those things happen and actually those things are praised. I think this is one of the most interesting things that dates O'Donovan's text, but is all the better for it, is halfway down, page 8, where he talks about abortion. He says, of all the arguments which ensured the victory of liberal abortion policy in Western societies, none, I think, was so influential than the one which many of us who wrote about the subject thought too crude to be taken seriously, the woman's right to self-determination in respect of her own body. Like, Derrida and Auden is a guy who's kind of done his ethical career through the era in which the thinking and policy around abortion has changed. He can harken back to a time where the whole idea of my body, my choice is a kind of footnote, is an outside, you know, a kind of outside horse in the race when it comes to getting this stuff through the door. Whereas now, that is the thing. Like, actually, arguments about kind of the medicinal and scientific side of it, whatever, are second to arguments about self-determination.
So why is the argument for women's right to self-determination, you know, so crude as not to be worth taking seriously from his perspective?
I don't think he doesn't go into detail here, but I guess if we take,
yeah, I mean, we have saying, kind of puzzle.
Yeah, if we take what he's been saying about what freedom is and what medicine is for, that it's for the treating of ill health and not for the overcoming of healthy bodies and the natural things that healthy bodies do, such as get pregnant, then it makes no sense to think that you know, just because the woman wants to have the child aborted, that you would do that, because, like, well, you're a woman with a healthy body, you're doing what healthy women do, having a child.
Yeah, for the
same
reason.
I think that's. Oh no, I was going to say, I think that's part of it, and then the other part, he sort of explicitly lays this out at the bottom of page 8, is that this kind of absolute freedom to self-determination over one's own body is impossible, right? Mm-hmm. You can't apply this universally, and so he gives two examples. He says, two examples. He says this: the freedom of self-determination which was accorded to the mother was won at the cost of the physician's freedom. Mm-hmm. So the woman's right,
it's like the incel problem,
get an abortion. That's right. It's the incel problem. That's exactly what you're saying. The woman's right to get an abortion has to come at the cost of the physician's right not to give an abortion. Mm-hmm. And so what you find is that
his right to do nothing, to go back
his right to do nothing. That's right. Yeah, and so and here's where I think he makes a very astute observation on page 9. He says the organization of mass medicine requires predictability of performance. Mm-hmm. And so once you have a kind of bureaucratic and technological apparatus, you need consistency with it. You know, it has to deliver a certain kind of consistency. That's one of the reasons for its existence in the first place, is this deliverance of consistency. And that sort of consistency undermines the possibility of agents who operate within that system to actually live in accordance with, you know, what they think is right. And so someone's rights are always coming at the cost of someone else's. Yeah, sorry, I'm rambling.
I think the and we're probably getting close to wrapping it up, but if I had to give thought as to why he thinks it's so crude as it isn't worth taking seriously, it would be that claims to bodily self-determination are at their face self-contradictory, because no one chose to get here when they got here. You know, mostly we have agreed, this one's a slightly weaker argument, but we've agreed that it's not acceptable for you to choose when to leave. You know, euthanasia, suicide. Also, you didn't choose which body you should be in. And the fact that you're requesting this right to self-determination is sort of proof that you don't have it, as opposed to certain other rights, right? So if I'm requesting, and now this isn't universally applicable or whatever, but don't con me, you know, like if I'm requesting that I have a right to speak, like by requesting, I am also simultaneously proving it in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyway, that's the level at which you it doesn't even work. It can't work.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think Colin, you're right. I'm just looking at the time. We're going to have to wrap it up there.
We made it like 3 pages, guys.
Mm-hmm. We strayed into page 9. I think bottom of page 8 at least.
Yeah, we strayed into the top of page 9. I got us across the finish line. You're welcome.
I was trying to hold us back. I was like, we could do it 55 minutes on one page. We can do it.
Colin is anti-progress. I am the progressive. Colin is not. All right. And on that note, we're going to switch to what we're reading. I think for the last episode, I forget who I asked first, but I went last. So I'm going to go first this time. I have continued since the last episode my tour through American literature. And I would like to talk about reading Fitzgerald. I really like F. Scott Fitzgerald. I hated The Great Gatsby when we had to read it, you know, like in high school or whatever.
Yeah, another one I did in school. Yeah.
I just never really understood it. Like, I don't really... Anyway, but I was talking to Eric Enlow, who's a Davenant board member, friend of the show, personal friend. I was talking to him. We got a great steak lunch. And I was like, just kind of ragging on Fitzgerald. And he's like, you know, you should, if you're doing this American thing, you should give Fitzgerald another look. Don't read Gatsby. Read. And then he gave me two titles. And the one I'll talk about today is Tender is the Night.
Mm.
Tender is the Night. It's like, I have not read it. It's really good. It's about expats living, you know, on the French Riviera. And it's kind of like, I mean, Eric described it to me as like, if you want a book that will show you that whenever anything is going good, it will go bad. That's the sort of book that this is, but it's a really good book. It's kind of like the rise and fall of a physician and his family in living, you know, the expat life abroad. But it's, you know, kind of connected to like new Hollywood and like, you know, the sort of post-war. It's really good. So I would recommend it.
Gatsby's when I studied Gatsby when I was in sixth form, so 12th grade, penultimate year of school, whatever you guys call it. And it's one of those books, actually, I somehow didn't, studying at school didn't kill it for me. I actually really fondly remember studying it and have gone back to it.
Everybody loves The Great Gatsby.
Except for me, apparently.
Yeah, really, we have that in common. I don't dislike it, but it doesn't...
Yeah, I don't love it, but I have fond memories of it. And I feel like it's held up when I've been back to it. Since.
Well, anyway, Tender is the Night, much better than Gatsby. Recommend. Colin, what are you reading?
I am also, I'm teaching a lot this January, and one of the things I've been teaching is J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. And so I'm working my way through Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. I know you might not be a fan, but I'm
listening through it on Audible at the minute, the unabridged audiobooks. Glorious.
Yeah, it's a fantastic read, and I have a great group of students who are reading through it with me. And you know, one of the things that I was just working through with them, and maybe actually I'm going to give you more of a comment on what I'm noticing in terms of student reception to it and how that's changed rather than the book itself. Okay. But as I'm teaching through it and reading along with them, you know, 5-10 years ago, I've taught this class, I don't know, 7 times or something. Students tended to get really excited by like the politics and his politics and the kind of like the Game of Thrones-esque aspect of, you know, is he going to win, blah, blah, blah. And I think it's in part because the generation of students up until COVID was sort of interested in politics. And so they're sort of projecting that into the book and the author. And this is the first time I've ever taught it post-COVID. No one wants to talk about any of that. They want to talk about the great chain of being, the nature of the good, all the stuff that I used to want to talk about. And the students were sort of like, nice. You know, bored as I droned on about it. They're actually engaged in that. And I actually brought that up to them. And their comment was, we broke the knob on politics, you know, a couple years ago.
We turned it up to 11.
And the whole generation is like, I don't want to deal with that ever again. If we could avoid it, let's just
tell me about being. No one's like, wouldn't there be mass popular support for Denethor and, you know, Aragorn's swanning in with his flipping sword?
Yep. Yeah. All right, Reese, what are you up to?
I'm listening to The Two Towers right now on audiobooks. But actually, I will share another audiobook so I can share a wonderful story. I've kind of been bitten by the Audible bug at last.
Oh, gosh.
But no, only for stuff that I've already read and is very familiar, and I just kind of like to have read to
okay.
me. Like, all right. I'm kind of all doing housework and stuff. So, yeah, so Lord of the Rings.
I know, but this is a what we're reading segment, and people do not read audiobooks. I will die on that hill. Audiobooks are not read, they are heard.
Oh, well, gosh. What have I been hearing then? So on the drive over New Year, must be kind of near end of January or early February by the time people hear this, but over New Year, we drove to my in-laws and we listened to The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe in the car. This gets worse for Ronsey by the second as I tell this story. but we put The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe on and my four-year-old was just, it's, you know, kind of a bit beyond her in terms of, you know, keeping up with it all, but she was just gripped by it. Like, just the idea of the wardrobe, of these children on this adventure, of a fawn. It was just kind of incredible. And she was asking me these questions. Every now and then, you know, weird question in the background, like, what color are Aslan's eyes? And things like that. But then it's stuff like, is the king coming? Yeah, the king's coming. Is he here yet? He's on his way. And then she's going to get a bit edgy when he's talking about the witch. And she's like, I'm scared about the witch, Daddy. Like, yeah, but Aslan's coming. Yeah, he's the king, Daddy. Yeah. Is he going to win? I was like, don't know. What do you think? Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So, like, that's it. She gets it. She gets reality and she gets fairy tales. And we did about half of it on the journey there and then the other half on the journey back. And, like, we ended up driving back quite late. So we left at the kids' bedtime, put them in their pajamas, bundled them in the car with their blankets. And I was like, yeah, put the audiobook on. They'll be asleep in, like, you know, 10 minutes. Like over an hour later, she's still awake, listening, wanting to know like what's going to happen. It's just like real kind of
that's
magic.
Fantastic.
So,
yeah, awesome. Well, spotlight, Reese. What are we spotlighting?
We're going to spotlight Adfontes memberships. We should do this every week, really, rather than just a kind of occasional spotlight thing. So expect to hear us plugging away and asking for your money more often. But at the time of release, it should be very imminent that our Winter 23 Adfontes print issue will be with you. We've got some exciting pieces in here. Gerald Bray, people might know, big name in kind of church history circles and evangelicalism, has got a great piece in there on Celtic Christianity and the myth thereof. If, you know, you get sick of people talking about kind of Celtic crosses and, you know, going out on some sort of windswept island on Skellig Michael to, you know, rediscover the ancient greenery of St. Patrick or whatever, then this is the piece for you. Matthew Hoskin of this parish, one of our teaching fellows, friend of the show, has a piece in there on Leo the Great in the theology of the Reformers. Leo the Great often sits in the shadow of Cyril of Alexandria when it comes to the Council of Chalcedon. Brad Littlejohn, our president,
well
reviewing Brad Littlejohn reviewing a book on the American founding by Richard Riley, I think, Catholic account of the founding. So there's just some great stuff in there. So you need to be a subscriber if you want to access those things. So you can either subscribe in print and online. It'll be too late to get the winter print edition, but you can get the spring one when it comes out. Or if you get a subscription for digital access, then you can access all the pieces when they're up shortly after this episode is out on adfontesjournal.com. So head there, head to the subscribe section. And subscribe.
Very good. Thanks, Reese. Well, as always, if you liked this episode of Adfontes, give us a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you hated it, Colin, what do they do?
I don't know why you're asking me, Anzi, because they have a right to have their voices heard, to self-determine the nature of the podcast that they listen to. And so they have to just manifest that right in reality to change the nature of the podcast until it conforms precisely with their desire and their will. And you know what? They can do it because I believe in them.
You know, Colin,
they can do it because they will have deep fake voice technology, which can listen to us and then create a totally fake version of this podcast that they prefer.
You both gave like the progressive. I just think they should start a competing podcast. You know, start your own. You know,
boo, build a thing.
No. Thank you, Ayn Rand.
We have. You got. Oh gosh, I'll have to tell you sometime about me reading Ayn Rand when I was in high school. It was bad. And on that note, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast, and we will see you next week.